I got so excited. I was too enthusiastic.
Coming up on Broadway Radios this week on Broadway, we talk with Wayne Bryan, the producing artistic director of Music Theater Wichita. We review the Broadway productions of Fun Home, Finding Neverland, and Living on Love. That plus a few more. Please stay tuned.
I never lost control due to overwhelming lust, but I must say that I'm changing my major to Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan. I'm changing my major to sex with Joan, with a minor in kissing Joan. Foreign study to Joan's inner thighs. A seminar on Joan's ass in her Levi's. And Joan's crazy brown eyes. Joan, I feel like Hercules. Oh, God, that sounds ridiculous. Just keep on sleeping through this and I'll work.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, April 26th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Critcherland, Masterworks Broadway, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good day. James, before we go on, let me say that last week when I was teasing John Moss about not sending me the Kentucky Lucky demo, he did point out that he did offer to send it to me electronically. It was the fact that I wanted a CD, and that's what it was. So he was gracious enough to offer me the demo, but not in the format that I wanted, and so that's why I was teasing him. But I want to apologize to him officially and let readers know that he certainly was good enough to offer me the demo electronically. I'm done.
Certainly glad we've corrected that.
For yes, I know.
Yes, the right. times regrets the error.
Yes, it really regrets the error.
But now we want to be friends with John Moss, so John, email me. So also
on
the
that
other
issue, on that issue,
on many issues, certainly,
oh, okay.
Certainly, you know, most of the iceberg is below the surface of the water. And so, but if he has that, he must have something else.
Okay, all right.
Interesting. The other voice that you heard was, of course, Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a photographer whose work can be seen at followspotphoto.com as well as many of the places on the internet. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
With us this morning, we have a very special guest. Joining us from Wichita is Wayne Bryan, the producing artistic director of Music Theater Wichita. Wayne, thanks so much for getting up early and visiting with us on a Sunday morning.
Thank you so much. I am so honored. There's a lot of my friends who think I'm finally legitimate now that I'm on the Broadway podcast. So this is really great.
Well, that's very kind of them to think. We're just a bunch of folks who are friends and talk about theater on Sunday mornings. That's what we do. So, Wayne, tell us what is happening at Music Theater Wichita these days. You have an upcoming show, upcoming season, number of shows this summer. So tell us about what's coming up.
Well, thanks for asking. Yes, Music Theater Wichita has been around since 1972, and I've been here since April Fool's Day, 1988. I came for what I thought was going to be a one-summer job, and obviously it turned into a lot more than that. So every fall, we announce our upcoming season. Every spring, we hold auditions around the country and line up artistic teams and designers and all those folks, because unlike most summer theaters now, none of our summer productions is a tour that comes from somewhere else. We build and design everything in the summer. So this summer's five shows are exciting for us. It's a mix of only two we've done before and three that are brand new, which in today's market, that's a really pretty good average of being able to bring new things. So we're opening with Elton John and Tim Rice's Aida, which we did 10 years ago. I'm very excited to have Zakiya Young and Andrew Szymanski and Kate Lopres doing the leads in that. And then 2 weeks later, we open the first professional production, I believe, of Disney's My Son Pinocchio, which is a hybrid of the TV movie Geppetto and the animated film Pinocchio, with some really lovely songs by Stephen Schwartz added to the mix. And then 2 weeks after that, we do the regional premiere here of Billy Elliot, which is daunting and challenging to put on in our kind of schedule, but we're optimistic and excited. Then 2 weeks later, we're doing Big Fish, which I think is really a wonderful show that didn't quite get the kind of presentation and reception that it needed in its New York debut. And then we're closing the season with Hello, Dolly, which has not been here for 21 years, and it was time to say hello to her again.
Well, let me say that I have been to Wayne's Theater many times, and it is an astonishing thing to witness because it is the place to be in Wichita. The crowds come out. I'm telling you, they are so loyal to him. I love the fact that I am sitting in that theater and people want to talk about it. And husbands, heterosexual husbands, are saying things like, I haven't missed a show since 1989. I mean, it's just marvelous to see. I mean, would that this could happen anywhere else. I mean, it astonishes me how they come out. And many of these seats, and this is not a small theater. How big, Wayne?
2,100.
Yeah, most of those seats are filled most of the time, you know, so it's just wonderful. And also, Wayne, of course, is terrific coming out with pre-show speeches that are very, very entertaining, and they just eat it up when he comes out. They know they're going to have a good time even when that happens, even before the show starts.
And let me say that I think I've only seen one of Wayne's productions, but it was the best production of Once Upon a Mattress that I've ever seen with Leah Delaria. I guess it was 42nd Street Moon. Is that right?
Yes, in San Francisco. Oh, my gosh. She's a handful. But
oh, wait. Let's hear a story. No. What happens backstage stays backstage.
No, it wasn't just backstage. My gosh.
I bet it was.
And she's got Lady Larkin and all of them posed like Charlie's Angels behind her. And she's got a very fertile brain, to say the least.
She's and so shy. I wish she would come out of her shell.
Oh my goodness, yes. And the first version of her nightgown to be on top of the mattresses was a typical sort of puffy sleeve little nightgown. But the tattoos along her arms all the way down to her wrists were so graphic that we had to add sleeves for the rest of the run.
It's all for the best. Yeah, no,
all for the best. But I'm glad you enjoyed it. And it was a treat working with that theater company again.
Oh, I did enjoy it. And it seemed to me that for all that, she was it was one of the most disciplined performances I've ever seen her give. So maybe you at least had some some effect on that.
So, all right, Wayne, how do you make it work? I mean, you know, Carol Channing's memoir has a sentence about growing up in San Francisco and talks about its great art museum. When I was little, she wrote, I saw Renoir, Monet, Picasso, Seurat, and a big Gauguin exhibit. Could you find that in Wichita? That's the image she uses to indicate a culturally devoid place. And yet you have made something work here that so many places in the country have not been able to make work. What's the secret?
When I was little, I saw Carol Channing. I don't know if that helps.
Yeah, that must be it.
Wichita, Kansas is on the south central part of the state. And I'm afraid the state, Kansas, does go out of its way to compound the feelings that people must have of a wasteland and a land that has uneducated or unsophisticated people. And I'm constantly disappointed that our state, as a state, can't seem to get a better grip on all the wonderful things it has to offer. I certainly did not anticipate staying in Wichita, Kansas when I first came, but it is a different situation down in Wichita. The people are uniformly warm and outgoing and curious about how you do your work, but not prying. They're a really interesting mix of friendliness, but let every person do their own thing kind of attitude. There are a lot of companies that had their bases in Wichita for a long time. Pizza Hut started there. It still is the center for a lot of the aircraft industry. Cessna, Boeing, Beech, Learjet, Spirit Aerosystems all have a presence in Wichita. And because those companies need to invite sophisticated executives and their families to come work in their state, there need to be cultural institutions and things to do which make the quality of life good. So the Wichita Symphony, which exists longer than music theater, is really excellent. We use their musicians in our very full pits every summer. The Wichita Art Museum has a world-class collection and a gorgeous Chihuly sculpture over its entranceway. Exploration Place is a tremendously unique science museum that was brought in about 2001. It was built. So there is a lot to do here, and you're not distracted, certainly, by skiing or surfing or any of the things you might have on the coasts. So the people support what they have here. They appreciate what they have here. And music theater was created in 1972 to fill a void in the programming for this new performing arts center that they had built downtown in the late 60s. The summers were empty in the concert hall, so they created this organization to fill that spot. And there's a lot of civic support, and certainly we do our best to deliver a quality product every single time. And the fact that we're now turning out so many young people who go to Broadway and make a name for themselves has extended our reach and our reputation. This year, as usual, when it was announced that we would be holding auditions, we received just over 4,000 pictures and resumes from actors and their managers. And we managed to see about 1,040 of them this year in six different cities. And then we hired 26, you know, that will come for the summer. And so when these kids spend a summer or four with us throughout their college careers, when they make the move to New York, they're confident, they're quick learners, they have a great work ethic, and they start booking shows instantly. And that's helped our reputation, too. We've got about 40 of them in this year's Broadway shows.
Wayne, you know, it's harder to get into Harvard than it is to get to Wichita. Oh,
I don't know that that's true.
No, just the numbers you just cited. Statistically, it's harder to get into music theater Wichita than it is to Harvard. So,
well, we're misguided souls. But
so, why don't you, for our listeners, name some of the folks who have come through Wichita onto Broadway?
Well, this year it was really fun, especially during our audition week in March. Not all the shows had opened, but we got to see Kristen Chenoweth on the 20th Century, along with, I think, three of our other alums in that show. We got to see Kelly O'Hara in The King and I, we were her first professional theater. Kelly.
Yeah.
Matt Bogart has been one of the stars of Jersey Boys for several years running now. Dante Keene was the associate choreographer on An American in Paris. Amy Dombo has painted backdrops in several of the Broadway shows and both of the NBC Live TV musicals. So we've got kids working behind the scenes and on stage, too. Emily Meckler is in The Visit. I'm trying to think what other shows we saw.
Josh Prince was with you too, wasn't he?
And all the choreographers, Andrew Palermo, who's got Allegiance coming in, Josh Prince, Josh Rhodes. Mm-hmm. So we've been very fortunate to attract good folks, and hopefully we help polish them up a bit and give them some connections and send them on.
Well, there's another factor as well, and that is that you never hear a bad word about Wayne Bryan. Yeah. Everybody adores this guy. Whatever he does with his cast and the way he treats them, and I've seen that a bit, you know, because I show up towards the end of the runs. But I'm telling you, you ask people about Wayne Bryan, and they put their hand over their heart, and they say, "Oh, Wayne." Yes, they do. They do. Face it. And I mean, it really is something. So, your skills with people must be sensational. So I think that has a lot to do with it as well.
So in other words, he doesn't emulate Jerome Robbins.
No,
I wouldn't let him walk into the pit.
Yes. Well, you know, I felt, you know, sometimes when I work at other theaters, when I used to work at other theaters as an actor or as a director, I would sense that the producer on some level didn't like actors or felt they were the enemy or the obstacle to be gotten around somehow. And I think oftentimes when I see a director or a producer that behaves that way, they are somebody who themselves wanted to be an actor but felt frustrated at their lack of success or whatever reasons. And I was an actor, not a hugely successful one, but a constantly working one. I did three Broadway shows, so I know what that's about and the pressure that comes as people get closer and closer to Broadway. And I have such empathy for the journeys that all these folks are on. And my hope, I guess, is that if we and the rest of our staff treat them like the talented professionals they are and trust that they have good instincts and should be listened to and put them together in a positive way, I hope some of them will become producers and directors who will treat other people humanely and with some consideration. It's not that hard. You get better results. And I just believe in that.
Go ahead, James.
I was going to ask you something about the business of Music Theater Wichita. In your press releases, you have an operating budget of $3.6 million, and 70% of that goes back into the local economy. What's it like, Wayne Bryan, coming to run this enterprise now? Did you sign up for that, or how did this happen? I mean, you know, it's like you got your MBA on the job.
I truly did. The only thing that saved me, well, I had come there as a director and actor in 1986. I had directed Oklahoma with Richard White and Rebecca Luker and Lara Teeter. And it was a really nice, Alex Corey. And then I played for Charlie in Where's Charlie the 2 weeks after that. So I had come for 4 weeks. And what struck me about Wichita in 1986 is you could not buy a drink with dinner in a restaurant. You saw people bringing in little brown paper bags with bottles in them. And I thought, oh, I really have reached the furthest outpost here. And I'm sure this is going to be an instructional 4 weeks, but I'm sure I'll be glad to get home to New York. And then 2 years later, they called and said the gentleman who'd been running it had taken a job in Houston. He was leaving immediately. Had I ever thought about being a producer? And I thought to myself, well, you know, it's Wichita, Kansas. No one will ever know if I'm really bad at this. This can't hurt anything. And I'm sure I'll learn something in one summer. And when I got there, for one thing, the liquor law has changed. Not that I had to have a drink with dinner. I just thought that was so curious. But things had changed. Downtown was starting to blossom. I think I had a budget of $800,000 the first year. And steadily, we were able to pay people better and attract more people. And our set and costume rental business now accounts for about 10% of our budget every year, which is a lovely thing. And I did, in fact, learn on the job. And the only thing that saved me, really, was the fact that I had never claimed to have any expertise at this. I never told anybody I could do it. I never petitioned for this job. And I was, I guess, their best option at that moment. So we all learned together. And it's been exciting to watch it grow and see how many people have come through the program.
What you have a 12-month operating enterprise there, aside from, you know, what's evident to audiences where you see, you know, 20-some-odd, 30-some-odd actors on a stage, how many people are in the production behind the scenes that are working on all year round, getting corporate donations for you guys, raising money, marketing the shows, developing and growing audiences? What kind of operation do you have there?
Well, during most of the year, there's just 8 of us. I'm the producing artistic director. Nancy Reeves is our company manager and my associate. Vicky Klein is finance. Angela Trotter handles our youth programs, the Jester Awards. Josh Larson is our box office manager. Jeff Taylor is our production manager. Mary Sue Dymack handles our rentals. And Angela Cassette is our new development director, been with us a year and a half and has overseen the change in our logo and our presentations, and a very valuable and terrific person. So there's just 8 of us. And then in the summer, we create about 300 jobs of people who come from all over. Stage managers, seamstresses, carpenters, lighting technicians, properties people, plus the casts, plus the orchestras, plus our front of house staff. So we become a big little city in the summer months.
This is all within 10 weeks?
Some of the staff show up 2 weeks earlier than that, but most of it is just 10 to 12 weeks. Yes.
All right. Now, you mentioned when you got there, you were directing Oklahoma, and you mentioned you were starring in Where's Charlie. So this summer, will you be directing? Will you be starring?
I will not be starring. I will be directing. I'll be directing Aida. Mark Madama is directing Aida. I'm directing My Son Pinocchio. Stephen Minning is directing Billy Elliot. I'm directing Big Fish, and Mark Madonna is directing Hello, Dolly.
Okay, now, given that you're doing Big Fish, will we see something that resembles the Broadway production, or do you have some different ideas of how to approach the material?
Very nice question, Peter Felicia. Thank you very much. We'll the answer is all of the above. We are utilizing great chunks of the Broadway sets and costumes, which now live in Long Beach, California. But we are building substantial amounts of new things, and we are taking a different approach on a lot of the musical numbers. I felt when I saw it first in Chicago and then in New York that the essential family story, which is the real reason to do that show, I believe, was sometimes a little bit lost in the expanse of the production numbers. And we're hoping to give the appropriate amount of spectacle, but also really hone in on the story of Edward Bloom, Sandra, and Will, and what makes them tick as a family. So some of our staging choices will emphasize them and de-emphasize a bit of the spectacle. But there'll still be plenty for Peggy Hickey to choreograph with the all of the circus numbers and the tap numbers and everything else that are in that show.
Now, I have a question about the Hello, Dolly. I'm, if I'm correct, this is not going to be the production with Leroy Reams as Dolly, is it?
Not to my knowledge, although things can change between March and when the show actually opens.
Because no, he's doing it. He's doing it somewhere.
Yes, he is, in Florida, in fact. do you have your Dolly, in fact?
I do. Her name's Catherine Kendall. Really terrific, professional, wonderful lady. Very funny. And Bill Nolte is the Horace Mann Geller.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're good friends, but they've never gotten to work together, so this should be ideal.
Yeah, tell us about the facility, the Century 2. How long have you been in there?
The theater was created to fill the summer slot in this building. The building was built in the late 60s and looks like it. The whole thing is a big round mothership sort of building with a blue roof. And it's divided into pies. So the 2,100-seat concert hall, the 600-seat Mary Jane Teal Theater, and two large all-purpose rooms, convention hall and exhibition hall, that can be turned into a lot of different kinds of performing venues.
So but that's not – you guys don't own that. It's a rental space
for
you?
It is owned by the city. We are a resident. Our business offices are in there as well.
Okay.
We've been in there for our whole life. There is no other facility in Wichita where we could do what we do. It's equipped with a wonderful carpenter shop, paint shop, costume shop, the things that cities used to have when they themselves were building their own shows.
All right. And you also mentioned that Angela, your new development director, has been with you for about 18 months. And we noted last year when Peter had come back and talked about your season that you lost the of in Music Theater Wichita. So is Angela responsible for stealing the of?
She is. She has secreted it away somewhere, and we don't know where. But it seems that, it seems that our logo was bolder and our city got more prominence if we just said Music Theater Wichita. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've done.
Well, what I really like, too, is the fact that you're doing Big Fish. And I remember you saying to me, I can do one Maverick show a year. And you certainly have. I mean, Betty Blue Eyes was one that we wouldn't have expected to see in your theater necessarily. When if somebody said, we're going to predict what Wayne's doing this year, I don't think we would have predicted Betty Blue Eyes, a show that had been in London and had not done terribly well there, but certainly pleased me and a lot of other people when we saw it. So it's nice that you do sneak in one that they haven't really heard of, and they trust you enough at this point to say, okay, we're just going because Wayne chose it and that's good enough for us.
Well, I hope so. I think it's a wonderful show. I think Andrew Lippa's score is just lovely and much underrated when it showed up in New York. And we have a terrific trio of lead actors. A terrific guy new for us, Vincent Carrazza, was in Rocky on Broadway, and he had done Mamma Mia, but he's mostly known for a big TV and voiceover career. But he came in New York and just charmed us and looked like he could play all the ages that character has to do on stage, from high school to 30-ish to end of his life. He just seemed like the guy for us. And Kim Huber has done a lot of roles for us. She was in the Broadway cast of Sunset Boulevard and Beauty and the Beast, and she'll be quite lovely as Sandra. And I think, Peter, didn't you see Catch Me If You Can last summer?
Indeed.
Skylar Adams, who was Frank
Jr. Oh, yeah, he was
Jr.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He'll be their son, Will. And I think it's a great trio of singing actors to bring it to life.
Well, Music Theater Wichita can be found on the web at mtwichita.org, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes, as well as if you go there, they have a wonderful website with links to their Facebook and Twitter, YouTube, and Pinterest accounts, and you can see some good videos and various different still photos from the productions and what else is going on out there. I encourage listeners to check out the website at the very least. If not, make a trip during that 10 weeks during the summer to go out and see it. And I'm going to try to get out there with my family as well to see a show. So, Wayne, thank you so much for joining us on
Wait, I have one more question.
What's your question?
Does Wichita's one and only burlesque theater still operate?
You know, there's a lot of debate about whether that strip really came from this city, took place in this city. We'd like to think it did. And when we did Gypsy last in 2010, we brought Eric Preminger, Gypsy's son. And I think he's as good a PR man as his mom was a PR woman. And so he totally embraced the idea that the burlesque theater was here. And then the Orpheum Theater, which is downtown, always lays claim to the fact that it might have taken place there. If you read Gypsy's, I want to say novel, but her autobiography, I think she places it in Kansas City, which is Missouri. But thanks to Arthur Lawrence and Mr. Sondheim and the good gang that created that fantastic show, one and only – the only insulting thing is when you do the scene change that leads you into the burlesque house, the little vaudeville scrolls go from on the road to the bottom
right.
which I beg to differ. So we do invite your listeners to come see for themselves. You fellas do such an amazing job on this, and this is such a worthwhile thing for those of us across the country that listen for the news of the new season every year, and the interviews like the one with Karen Morrow. Just so great. Thanks for doing this.
Oh, Wayne, why don't you share with us, do you think it's okay to share that story about Karen Morrow?
Oh, sure, she'd laugh. Well, we haven't gotten to work together, but we've been in and around each other in lots of situations. So one of my visits out to Los Angeles, where I grew up, I was in one of the supermarkets there, and a figure that I wasn't really noticing glided by me with her shopping cart. And this was a person with a kerchief and possibly curlers, I don't know, but walked past, and then I heard that familiar voice say, "It isn't pretty, but it wants to say hello." And it was Karen Morrow.
Oh, Wayne, thank you so much again. Michael, any questions before I wrap up? I don't want to cut anybody short.
No, but thank you for sharing that story. That was just delightful.
So, Wayne, thank you so much again, and let us know how things are, and hopefully one of the three of us or three of the three of us will get out to see you this summer.
I will look forward to it. We'll put out the red carpet.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow, it's great to speak with Wayne and show us that, once again, as we point out very often, not all great theater happens in New York. And very excited about that. I'm really trying to get out there this summer to Wichita to see some shows. The three of us have had a very busy schedule in the last couple of weeks, and this week included Fun Home, the show that is playing up at Circle in the Square right now. And Peter, why don't you start us off with that?
Yeah, this is, of course, an excellent musical, as we learned last year. I liked it even more in Circle in the Square. I'm talking about the configuration. It was great fun to be so much more close to the Bechdel family. That's Allison, that's Helen, and Bruce. There are two kids, this brother and sister as well. No, two brothers. Anyway, the other two kids really fade away. They're not really very much a part of the story. But certainly, to compensate for that, we have two other Allisons. There's small Allison, there's middle Allison, and there's the adult Allison. And the show would be worth seeing just for these three women, because Sydney Lucas is amazing as the little girl and has a very important song when a delivery woman comes in and she's attracted to her. Even though she's a little girl, she's intrigued by her as well as attracted. The set of keys that she has on her, the laced boots, the masculine demeanor. And it's there's, of course, a very famous book about being gay called When I Knew. And this was essentially when she knew. So she's marvelous in that song, and marvelous also with the two other kids doing the title song of the show. Fun Home is the euphemism for funeral home. They live in a funeral home because Bruce does that as well as being a high school teacher, and he scavenges for bric-a-brac. He's a busy guy. And yet, as we all know, when you really want something, you make time for it. And he does make time to meet with young men and have sex with them. And, of course, that's the big crux of the show. It's really something when Allison finds that out about her father and finds out about herself, too. Middle Allison, Emily Skaggs, great performance as this girl going to college, standing in front of the gay union door and not having the nerve to go in. Really having a tough time coming to terms with the fact that this is what she's going to be, and has a marvelous song on the show, Once She Does Fall in Love. I'm not going to give too much away about it, but it's so terrific, and it's the feelings we've all had when we've fallen in love for the first time and nothing else in the world exists. So that's really great. My favorite part of the show, though, I have to say, no, let me talk about Michael Cerveris, who's really good, and Judy Kuhn, who's really good, too, before I get to my favorite part. Michael really shows the torture of a man who's a father of three and has very little patience with his kids, you know, because he's an unhappy guy. When you're an unhappy guy, you know, you have a very short fuse. And Judy Kuhn is very good at being in not quite denial. She knows what's going on, but, you know, this is a story that takes place way back when. And as a result, you know, you're a woman with no marketable skills and three kids, where are you going to go? And that's her dilemma. And she has a marvelous song about that, warning her daughter about be careful who you get involved with, which is a very potent song. My favorite part of the show, early on. Middle Allison is struggling with her feelings and she blurts out, "Please, God, don't make me a lesbian." And the audience responds with a good-natured laugh, one that says, "Honey, you have nothing to worry about. You're going to be all right." And that laugh shows us how far we've come. And let me tell you, it's something that Bruce could have used in the 50s when he was coming of age. Yeah, so that's the most reassuring thing to me in the show. And it's one of the reasons, but not certainly the only reason, why I liked Fun Home quite a bit.
So, Michael, what did you think about it?
It's a lovely show. The timing was, I have a house guest and from Columbus, Ohio. And so I offered him to come to with me to see whatever I was seeing this week, that the 4 or 5 days that he happens to be here. And the first thing was Finding Neverland. And that didn't go over very well. And so I said, "Well, I think you tomorrow you will have an unimaginably better experience at Fun Home." And indeed, he did. It's a wonderful show anyway. And I think just in comparison with some or most of the other new quote unquote musicals this season, it's an absolute gem. It's got heart. It's got real characters. It's funny what you said earlier, Peter. I was thinking that it's all based on Alison Bechdel's actual life, and so I assume it's true that her father was all of those three things: a funeral home director, a high school English teacher, and also a house restorer. And I thought at first, you know, it's a little. Does he have to be doing three things like that? It makes it a little confusing in a way. But I'm sure that that's what Peter alluded to. Someone, if they feel very unhappy in some way, I think a lot of times people like that tend to try to fill their lives with activity and other things to keep busy and keep their minds, you know, and their emotions interested in order to not focus on the unhappiness. So even that thing, which I thought of maybe as a slight flaw, I think is actually not a flaw and says a lot about that character. It's a wonderful, wonderful show. I thought another minor thing, I thought that the three Allisons looked quite different in terms of body type and also in at least one case, hair color. And although I know that people's hair color and body type changes through the years, especially from age 8 to whatever, however age she's supposed to be at the end. That's different than showing it on stage where you want to, I think, maybe have a little bit more of a through line. So it didn't bother me a lot, and certainly not, you know, considering the talent of these three women, but that was something that also I wasn't conscious of that off Broadway, and I know that one of them was different. So I guess maybe there was more of an attempt there to make them look a little closer together, but really what a cast. Judy Kuhn, absolutely superb as the mother. She gets her, I guess, big number towards the end of the show, and it's well worth waiting for. Roberta Calindres, who plays, the person who helps Allison come out, at school, she was really fantastic, and Joel Perez in a number of roles of the young men in the father's life, I guess you would say. It's a beautiful show. I do wish it great success. It would be very, very sad and scary if a show like this cannot be successful when some of these other things are playing. So we'll hope for the best with that.
One of the things that annoyed me about, I shouldn't say, wasn't really the show, was that in the playbill, they had no song list.
Listing, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's no song list. And I was like, you know, they usually sort of do that, cut the song list to prevent any spoilers, but they were. I don't think that the song list would have created any spoilers in here.
Well, in fact, I went looking at the cast album so I could get the titles of songs when I was writing about the show. And the song that I was alluding to, where she falls in love desperately and nothing else in the world matters, is very cleverly obfuscated. It uses three words instead of five. The five would give away what's going on, and they just use three. Again, I know I'm being oblique, but again, I want to be, and obviously they want to be too. But I'm with you. I like seeing songs listed. Frankly, in some shows like Finding Neverland, it's good to know how many you have to go before the show ends. You count, you know. So, but anyway.
So I enjoyed the production. I just felt that the kids' commercial song, was amazing, but it was just so out of sorts with the rest of the show. If somebody were to see that on the Tony Awards, which I'd imagine that they're going to see that on the Tony Awards, and they're like, oh, let's buy tickets to Fun Home, and they get there, and they're like, what the hell was that?
Well, maybe it's a good thing if that happens, because maybe they'll be drawn into the show, too. But it is nice to show that there were times in the family when fun did happen, and kids were allowed to just be kids. So I think that's admissible into the equation.
And because it happens early on. And I think that's the point there. One other thing. I do think that although it was directed about as well as possible, I think, by Sam Gold in the round setup, I did think there were several times when I was not seeing people's faces, and which is only natural. Yeah. And it would have been a little better if they had stuck with the usual basically three-quarter thrust configuration of circle in the square, and had the back wall where the band was, not have people sitting in you know, in back at that part, and then they could have used, you know, it would have been closer to, well, you know what I'm saying. It would have eliminated some of the being backs to people, to the audience. Yeah.
Michael, I have an out-of-town guest as well who went to Fun Home and sat in that section behind the band, and he was very upset before the show began, saying, oh, this is going to be terrible. And he said it was no problem at all. The only thing he was surprised is that the back of the scenery wasn't covered, that it looks rather rustic and rough-hewn. But all things considered, he had a fine time sitting there. So, that's always the thing in the round. Of course, it always will be. And but I find more assets for this show in the round than I did. And I loved Ed at the Public. Don't misunderstand me. But I was even more thrilled to see it here. Or maybe it was a case just because I was seeing it the second time. I could afford to see it in a different type of setting and enjoyed it for that reason.
But don't misunderstand me. Yeah, because you it's the increased intimacy because when you think about it, most people seeing it at Circle in the Square are going to be far closer to the action than most people who saw it in a regular proscenium setup the Newman down at the Public. So I agree with that completely. All I'm saying is that if they had stuck with the usual 3/4 thrust setup, that wouldn't have made it less intimate. It just would have meant that there weren't people sitting in that section. But again, there were only a few moments when I felt that I was seeing a little bit too much of people from the side or the back, and it is done as well as anyone could possibly do in the round, and because they did it in the round, partly that also leads to some very interesting things with sets coming up through the floor. And I won't say any more about that.
Okay.
I'd like to ask a question of the two of you, and I want to preface this by saying this quite possibly might be the stupidest question I've ever asked on Broadway Radio, and I recognize that, so I don't want the listeners to get all out of sorts about this. But, so, you know, we all know that Michael Servais is chosen to be bald. He shaves his head. Mm-hmm. And I thought that the wig that the character wore in the show was one of the worst wigs I've ever seen on Broadway. And I'm wondering if you thought that that's a choice, that the father is actually bald and wears an uncomfortable wig.
That's a great question. That's a great question.
But it bothered me for the whole thing. I was like, this is the worst wig I've ever seen on Broadway. And then I started to think maybe it's a choice.
Well, but is it also, James, was it the worst wig you've ever seen? Or is it just that you're so used to seeing Michael
with no hair? Yeah.
No. It was a really bad wig. I mean, we see great wigs on Broadway all the time.
Sure.
Productions, I for the listeners out there, if you ever wonder why Broadway tickets are so expensive, you should price out a wig. Wigs are thousands of dollars, and they have to be maintained and things like that. But I thought that was a really bad wig.
But I agree with you. It is worth investigating to see if Bruce in real life was bald and did wear a wig, because I think he would, because, again, he wants to attract these young guys. So he doesn't want to look any older than he has to. So I think that's a very good observation.
Hmm. And I shared Michael's observation about the three Allisons not looking alike and things like that, and it bothered me for a few minutes, and then I was over it. But certainly the talent on that stage, oh my goodness!
Oh yeah, and I mean when Alexandra Socha did it downtown, I thought she was magnificent as well. But they didn't lose a whit by getting Emily Skeggs. She is just sensational, endearing. Everything that character has to be in being flummoxed, and we've all been in that situation where we were interested in a person romantically, and we don't know the right words to say, and we're looking for the right words, and we know we're saying the wrong thing, and we're trying to say the right thing. We say the right thing at the wrong time and the wrong thing at the right time. And and she does all that so beautifully.
And does anybody know if Alison Bechdel and Beth Malone sort of look alike, or?
Yeah, they do.
They do?
Yeah, there's a concerted effort to make her look like the real Alison. Yeah.
Because I was thinking it's like the Rachel Maddow musical.
Oh, there is an analogy, isn't there? Right. Yeah, good point. Good point. Yeah. Yeah, she does look like Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, there is that, there's that look.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. All right. So anything else you guys want to add before we move on?
No, we got to move on. We got a lot to talk about.
Absolutely.
All right.
So next up on the agenda is our Finding Neverland.
We've already tipped our hand on it.
Yeah. Did we find the Neverland? Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
I think it was one of the most aggressively awful things I've ever seen in my entire life. I was just looking at the movie a little bit after seeing the musical.
Oh, I love the movie. And it's one of my favorites.
1 minute of it has more charm and wit and talent than you can find in the entire musical put together. Another interesting thing is, we had discussed that we have American in Paris and Gigi on Broadway, and both of those come from movies that were directed by Vincent Minnelli and both starred Leslie Caron. We were watching, I was watching a little bit of the movie of Dr. Zhivago, and there was, of course, the scene was with Julie Christie and actually Tom Courtney. And then I put on Neverland, and Julie Christie plays Sylvia's mother. Right. I had completely forgotten that. So we have two Julie Christie musicals on Broadway right now. But that was just to lighten the mood for a moment in talking about the awfulness of Finding Neverland. I don't know who this is supposed to be for. I mean, well, I do know who it's supposed to be for, children and families, but it's about the creation of the original play Peter Pan, but it's more about Barry's relationship with the kids and the mother, and the father of the Welland Davis family is already dead when the musical starts, and then the mother, I hope this isn't a spoiler, dies during it. You know, it's and a lot of it is about subject matter that I don't think will appeal to children at all. I also think it's weird that they're doing everything possible to associate this property with Peter Pan, including the logo, that they use on the Playbill cover and elsewhere. But there is almost no actual flying in it. There is a couple of, I don't know, maybe like the last minute of it, you see the woman playing Peter in the play within the play. She flies, and then the only other example is one of the low points of the entire show, where they have this tremendously obese 45-year-old man flying during a rehearsal of the play, and we're supposed to think that this hugely obese 45-year-old man is going to be playing one of the children in the Darling family. Now, is it work that to make a fat joke to go to that extent of insulting the audience's intelligence? I mean, but look at the other things that they did to insult the audience's intelligence. There's a joke that completely takes everyone out of the play. There's a reference to Cheers, and Kelsey Grammer looks at the audience and does a big take, and the audience goes, oh, ho, 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 and then he does his punchline. Which is weird because Cheers is not mentioned in Kelsey Grammer's bio, nor is Frasier. He doesn't mention any of his TV work. What is that all about? Mm. I didn't get that. And then this unbelievably offensive, disgusting joke. I'm not sure exactly what the setup is, but they're rehearsing Peter Pan, and someone says to one of the actors something like, "Don't you know what a fairy is?" And he says, "I've been in the theater for years. I know what fairies are." And the audience laughs at that. And to me, that is the exact equivalent as if someone said, "We're going to go coon hunting later. Do you know what coons are?" And someone said, "Yeah, I know what coons are. I used to do minstrel shows." I mean, how is it different from that? It's unbelievably, disgustingly offensive, and I would be a amazed if it was in any other show other than this one, which seems to have no sense of taste, no sense of style, no sense of wit or charm. They steal from everything. There's a ridiculous love duet between Barry and Sylvia, which it was. I was reminded that in the film, it's really not that kind of a love story. They care for each other very much, but it's platonic, basically. And they have this silly love duet where they're dancing around, doing awful choreography, and then they do a scene that's a pose that's right out of Titanic, the film with Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet. That, you know, that famous thing with the arms extended. What else? The lyrics are beyond inept. The one I wrote down is Kelsey Grammer sings, "I've heard enough, you're losing your mind, you're speaking in riddles, and the riddles don't rhyme." And that wasn't even necessarily the worst lyric, but I singled that one out because I thought it was so ironic about someone saying that something doesn't rhyme in a lyric that itself doesn't rhyme. Riddles aren't supposed to rhyme, but lyrics are. So I thought that was unbelievably strange. And I guess that's really all I have to say before I turn it over to Peter and James, because I know both of you were at the same performance that I was.
Oh, Peter was there too.
Yeah.
Oh, I saw Michael. I didn't see Peter there. So Peter, tell us what you thought.
Michael liked it a lot more than I did.
Wow. Wow. I'm sorry.
I dare say I've seen 80 to 85% of the Broadway musicals of the last half century. I may be off a percentage point or two, but not by much. And I have never seen worse choreography. Mm. Frankly, let's start at the very beginning here, because at the beginning, we're at the opening of J.M. Barrie's new play, not Peter Pan, that comes later, but it's his new play, and all the first nighters are there. And they do choreography that has nothing to do with British people in the turn of the century. It really looks as if they have, say, Vitus dance. And as time goes on, I realize that I had seen this choreography before in 1966 when I saw Marat Sade. They act as if they're crazy people, as if they're genuinely insane in an asylum. Mm. So terrible, terrible choreography. Another problem, I did watch the movie, and the movie is substantially better than the show, and a lot of the decisions made really, really dragged it down. For one thing, Sylvia, in the J.M. Barrie's wife, who in the movie is disappointed that her husband has taken an interest in this other family, this woman, and these four boys, and she tries to be dignified and nice about it, but she's very disappointed, and eventually she will do something very radical to make the marriage end. Here she's a bitch from the very beginning, and she's pretentious, and I don't see why that had to happen.
So Peter, let me just jump in. This is Mary Barrie.
Oh, is it Sylvia? Sylvia's right. Thanks.
Sylvia's the other.
Right. Okay. All right. So, so I think that's a real problem. Another thing in the movie, when he meets these children, they're very British. They're very polite, and they don't want to bother him. They're always apologizing, that type of thing. And you can tell they're really well brought up in the way that we think of children being brought up. Then these kids come on, and they're very American and very rambunctious. Now, that in itself is a tiny problem, but it leads to a bigger problem, because there's a big thing here about the fact that these boys have not gotten over the fact that their father died suddenly and unexpectedly. Well, these kids seem to have gotten over it tremendously easily, so that's a big problem as well. I agree with Michael entirely on the fairy line, but as bad as it is, it's bad on another level as well, because it is the type of obvious joke. When you're working on a show like this, it's so easy to write a joke like that, because there's the word fairy, there's the word theater. Okay, fine, you can link them up. And but the thing is there anybody in the audience who is totally taken by surprise by that? And so therefore, it's a lousy joke from a writer's standpoint. What broke my heart, Michael said people laughed at it. Yes, they did, but he also knows they applauded it too. Mm. And that was something that really disgusted me very much. There's also an unbelievable Abbott Costello, who's on first routine, because with the word darling, who are you playing? Darling. Yes, thank you. You're calling me darling. No, no, no. I'm playing. That's ridiculous beyond belief. Charles Frohman, the producer, at one point says, oh, when Peter Pan's opening, oh, the years I've waited for this. Charles Frohman had been producing for over a decade at that point. It makes it sound like it's his first production. So I thought that was stupid as well. One thing I think that should come up, that never does. Doesn't come up in the movie either. All right, so he tells the little boy named Peter that he is naming this character after him. What are the ramifications when Peter finds out that he's being played by a girl? I think that should be dealt with. I think that's worthy of a discussion. For me, it really this to me looked like a musical put together by people who have seen musicals like The Bandwagon and assume that that's how musicals are done. It had nothing to do with it didn't seem to me they had been in the trenches and really seen what musicals were like. Now, of course, Diane Paulus, the director, did the successful revival of Pippin. Some of us had issues with that, but that's another story. But it really looked as if these people had never seen a musical before beyond the Hollywood cliches. And that's really one of the reasons why. However, again, James and Michael have to admit as well, wherever these people came from to see this show, they had a hell of a time. They enjoyed it immeasurably, and I think some of that has to do with the fact with somebody we haven't even remotely mentioned, and that's Matthew Morrison. I think they're just thrilled to be in the same room with this guy and with Kelsey Grammer, and who could ask for anything more? I think they're just very happy to be with these two people whom they consider luminaries from TV, and that'll swing it for them. So who knows what'll happen as the weeks go on. Of course, you know, after the bad reviews, they immediately announced their tour that's coming up next year, as all productions in trouble do, to make us believe that they're successful. But
American in Paris also announced a tour as well. Yes. I noticed this week.
Yes. Yeah, it's the thing to do to make you seem more successful. And all things considered, I will be very interested to see if the audience I saw Finding Neverland is typical of the audiences that will come. I have no idea if all these people got in free or if they paid top dollar. But whatever the case may be, this truly is a stinker.
So we're going to have a unanimous report here because I really had a terrible time. I really considered leaving at intermission because we're having such a tough week to fit in so many shows at the end of the season. I was like, I don't know if I can dedicate another hour of my life to this terrible show. But my wife loved it.
Good.
Wife loved the first act. And
I'd rather her have a good time than agree with us.
That's very nice.
That's
yes.
Your line. Yeah.
Yeah. I repeat that to everybody. And I think it's a really great thing. And the rest of the audience was really having a wonderful time. Mm, and I was like, am I watching a different show from 17 inches away from my wife? Mm. And she loved it. And so we stayed for the second act and it didn't get any better. Had some really nice, let me say some of the nice things about the show that I really enjoyed some of the special effects that they did and some of the very low-tech things that they did. When some of the flying was happening in the show, they had people come and pick up the people and fly them, like they lift them around like I do with my daughter, and I fly her over my head or something like that. And I thought it was much more clever than spending an enormous amount of money on flying by foyer or something like that to fly people around the production.
Well, another factor is that when Sylvia, right, is sick, they bring the show to her, so they wouldn't be able to, you know, bring in all the apparatus to make people fly. So that's, they really had to do that in that sense.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
They do everything possible to like try to give you all of Peter Pan in 5 minutes so people can feel like they've seen Peter Pan as
well.
But also, what was with that wig? Talking of wigs, what was with that wig on that girl? Is that what we want?
Peter Pan wig?
Yeah, she looked
I don't know.
An afro or something. I don't
know. Yes, it was. It was very afro, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, also, Peter brought up Matthew Morrison, and it is wonderful to be in a room with Matthew Morrison. And I spoke with Peter earlier this week about Matt Morrison versus Jeremy Jordan. And I said to Peter, and I don't know if you two support this, is that Matt Morrison is very talented, and Jeremy Jordan he's very talented as well. But it seems that in my mind, Jeremy Jordan would have been too young for this role. So, in that case, Matt Morrison seemed to be perfectly suited for this role in the age thing. I don't know if anybody agrees or disagrees with me about that.
Well, I didn't see the previous, but apparently the beard, he did have a beard, and that in itself just helped a lot to make him look better. And I can't say. As I think I mentioned, I was incredibly turned off by Matthew Morrison in a performance he gave at Carnegie Hall a couple of months ago. So I have that in my mind. I would say he did as well as anyone could under the circumstances. His Scottish accent certainly sounded credible to me, and I thought he sang it fine. But the material, Jesus.
No, the material. And that brings me to one of my next points is that have either one of you heard any of the material by the previous writers?
Only one song called In the Blink of an Eye, which I think...
Peter, remind us who the previous writers were.
Yeah, Scott Frankel and Michael Corey, the Grey Gardens guys. And Scott Frankel was not above going on Facebook on the day the reviews came out and saying Schadenfreude, because he wasn't unhappy the way it played out. And I don't blame him because sight unseen, I guess, ears unheard. I would like to hear their score. The one song I have heard in the blink of an eye, I think, would have been a very successful song for many audiences. So their score for great. These are quality writers, no question. I do believe that for people who came from the rock world, they often, these new guys, they often hit the mark with making the score sound right for the era, but just as often didn't. There's one song in the first act that sounds like a 60s bubblegum song that you might have heard the Monkees do.
It sounded like the Beatles, like Maxwell Silver Hammer.
One of those. And I mean, so it was totally anachronistic, but every now and then they really sounded as if they were right for the period. So I don't condemn the score. I didn't like it, but I don't condemn it. And but I'll bet that those other guys who are really super talented did a better job.
Oh, I condemn this score. No, I do. I think the few moments when it sounded remotely period was just because of the orchestration with like flute or but there was almost always that underbeat of modern day pop, and I guess that is what kind of led to the some of the ridiculously awful choreography. Not to mention, I mean, can we actually believe that Diane Paulus directed this?
What's so funny to me is before we started talking, I should tell the listeners that we said, we're going to be brief today because we have so many things to talk about. And here we are going on and on about Finding Neverland because there's so much to look at and find flaws in. So what can we do?
So, I'm going to keep up my count here of number of producers. We have 25 producers on Finding Neverland, a little bit more than the cast, and some strange billing.
I should also say that in cases like this where we may seem to be being very harsh and also, mention of Schadenfreude in terms of when people read about what they consider bad shows getting awful reviews, I really think that sometimes it's justified. And they say, some people are just jealous because they couldn't have careers in theater themselves. I mean, maybe that's true to some extent in some cases, but I think for the most part, what we hear, the situation here is just real anger and frustration that something so bad could ever, ever make it to Broadway.
Well, the thing is that, you know, I think that both you and Michael and Peter have enumerated the ways in which that we feel that these certain areas of the show should have been done in a more artistic or different directions. It's not that they were just like saying it sucks and we really hate it, you know, type of thing. You've really explained the areas that we feel are wanting. And it's funny because there seems to be this mini riot that goes on over at Talkin' Broadway when Matthew posts a review, Matthew Murray, who's a chief theater critic of Talkin' Broadway, and is also a dear friend of mine. And when folks, Matthew will post a review that, Talkin' Broadway posts Matthew's review of something that Matthew didn't particularly like, there's this rage on the boards there that Matthew doesn't like
anything.
hates theater and hates everything, and why is he a reviewer and things like that. And the bottom line is that, you know, he loves just as much, if not more, than what he hates. And then that is explained over and over. But, you know, talking about reviewers is not, you know, it's been around since the dawn of time. Since there's been a reviewer, there's been critics or reviewers, and you know, and I think that, you know, we try to really explain, you know, what was wanting from our points of view.
Oh no, absolutely. But what I just, you know, just to end it,
yeah,
what I meant is when people get angry and very harsh, as we sometimes do, I feel that I really try to reserve it for things like this that are just beyond the pale.
So the last thing I'm going to mention about Finding Neverland is that that Kelsey Grammer took over for Michael McGrath, and Michael McGrath's on the 20th Century right now. But Michael McGrath took over for Roger Bart. Let's remember that. Was it in the reading or the production?
I didn't know that.
And
I think it happened before they got to Cambridge.
Before they got to Cambridge, so it was still in the developmental stage. And Doug Sills played it in the workshop. And just very briefly, for just a moment, is that Doug Sills is in Living on Love at the Longacre Theater with Renee Fleming. And we had Doug on 3 or 4 months ago or so, and talking when we were talking about Mr. Magoo, weren't we, Michael?
Yes,
Doug.
Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol.
Mr. Magoo's Christmas Carol, and so I'll link to Doug's interview. And it's funny, we just hinted at the Living on Love thing, and so we see how fast these things can happen. Just I guess it was December or so that Doug didn't know he was coming to Broadway yet in Living on Love, and I thought he was wonderful, and I really enjoyed the show. And the show doesn't seem to be selling well, so I don't know if it'll be around for very long. Also, we talked about a few weeks ago that I had heard that the Heidi Chronicles was in jeopardy, and it seems that that has come to fruition, that it's going to be closing early, which is so unusual to close, you know, right before Tony's announcements, right before Tony nominations. You would think that they would have held that announcement for a week to see if they got any nominations to hold on there and boost box office, but it's a science for these folks, and they've figured out that it wasn't going to help. So
and on another note, on the Fantastics had been announced.
Yeah,
to close.
Yeah.
But the Fantastics had been announced to close, but now they have issued a press release saying that two anonymous donors are going to keep the show open, which sounded odd to me because you don't usually think of people donating to a commercial production.
Well, on behalf of the entire theatrical community, Michael and Peter, I want to thank you for those donations.
That's right. I do love that show.
Who knew you had a few million sitting around in the mattress? Just
exactly.
Throw into the
James, for all you're paying us, we, you know, with the money we have left over, I mean, why not give it to the Fantastics?
This is true. It really, if you do have the means, I highly recommend it.
Mm-hmm.
So let's. I want to. We're just going to wrap up here and talk about. Let me get this correct, Michael. Cavalleria.
Cavalleria
Rusticana
and
Rusticana and Paiacci. So I have slaughtered everything at the Metropolitan Opera. So Michael saw this and so wanted to tell us quickly about it.
Oh, I'll be brief. These are new productions of the two one-act operas. They're almost always done together. They replace an incredibly beautiful or two incredibly beautiful productions by Franco Zeffirelli that were in the rep at the Met since, I believe, 1970 or maybe even earlier than that. And those two were very beautiful and also to use the word that someone else really used recently used, painstakingly realistic recreations of these goings on in Italian villages in roughly around 1890. These two new productions directed by Sir David McVicar, set designed by Ray Smith, costume designer Moritz Jung, lighting designer Paul Constable. They are – well, the first one, Cavalleria Rusticana, is very minimalist, and the set consists basically of a bunch of chairs and a couple of tables, long tables. The Pagliacci is more – has more sets. It's supposed to be taking place like in a truck stop in Italy. And for some reason, for that one, they moved the action up to 1949. It's not remotely traditional. The Pagliacci replaces, because it's moved up to 1949, it replaces a Commedia dell'arte performance with a vaudeville style performance. And I did not like the productions. The musically, of course, it's the Met, and it was there was a lot of beautiful music going on, especially from the singing of Marcello Alvarez, who played the tenor leads in both operas, which doesn't always happen, but in this case it did. And he got to sing. Pagliacci, of course, has the most famous tenor aria, I think, in history, Ridi Pagliaccio, so he got to sing that. What I wanted to say, make a general comment is that I think it's fair to say that for decades in opera, productions tended to be, for the most part, with very few exceptions, very, very realistic and traditional. And then that started to change, I guess, later than the rest of, than the theater did. The style of opera productions didn't really start to change until, oh gosh, I don't know, maybe like the 80s or 90s, I'm going to say. But now we've gone to the opposite extreme. And now you almost never see a traditional realistic production, although one exception is the recent Merry Widow at the Met. So for someone who wants to see something that resembles what you might have seen in the old days, I would recommend that one to you. And by the way, it has come back into the Met repertoire, although obviously Kelly O'Hara, neither Kelly O'Hara, nor – yeah, exactly. neither Kelly nor Renee Fleming are in it because they are both on Broadway. So that's just a general thing I noticed in opera production, and I wish it was. It's going to get to the point where maybe it'll swing back at some point, and the realistic productions will be so few that they will then themselves seem novelties, and maybe that'll happen and it'll swing back. But I don't know if that's going to happen in my lifetime.
So. Yeah, I will link to that plus all the other stuff in the show notes. Anything else you guys want to add before we close up?
I did just want to mention briefly, because it has a very short run, Speakeasy Dollhouse is a series of immersive plays. I'm reading from the release here, based on Cynthia von Bueller's investigations of mysterious deaths. And these are done in site-specific historic locations. The previous ones were called The Bloody Beginning and The Brothers Booth, but the current one is called Ziegfeld's Midnight Frolic. And if you can get there in the next 2 weeks, I believe it's running through May 9th, it's being held in the Liberty Theater on 42nd Street, which is the one I have two, I guess, old theaters that have not been renovated or torn down, and so you get to see this old theater that's in the located in the back of what is now the Liberty Diner on the south side of 42nd Street. And it's really – it's quite creatively done. It's an immersive experience. The first part of it is basically a like a Ziegfeld – well, not really. Yeah, sort of a Ziegfeld-style review with old songs like Let's Begin from Roberta and people performing as Josephine Baker and Fanny Bryce. And then you get to wander around the theater and see various scenes happening, backstage and in the balcony. So it's really quite something. And it's basically about, Olive Thomas, who is the woman whose ghost is supposed to haunt the New Amsterdam Theater, which is right next door to the Liberty. And it's about the circumstances of her death, which I guess are still mysterious to this day. So I would really highly recommend it. Very, very, very creative.
All right. And I'm looking at their site, and it's going – they have tickets on sale through June 6th, actually.
I'm sorry. Then you know what?
They've updated it since they've sent out their press release. Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Fantastic. So you have to see it.
All right. So next week, we are going to talk about a few things. First, our Shalina Kennedy from Beautiful, who took over the Carole King role from Jesse Mueller, is going to join us and talk a little bit. We'll talk about The King and I and Dr. Zhivago. Oh, that was a tongue twister.
That was a tongue twister.
Yeah. And we are going to talk about our trivia question in just a second. But before we do that, I want to remind listeners that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link that way each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many different ways, the Stitcher app. You can listen to us on Broadway World Radio. Broadway World Plays is at Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, Michael, and me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. And we have a bunch of videos from Music Theater Wichita and other great stuff there. So if you're interested, head over to Broadway Radio and check that out. All right, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's trivia question?
Yes, I asked what Tony-winning playwright did the logo for a 60s Broadway musical. And the answer is Herb Gardner, who did Conversations for My Father and won a Tony for it in the 80s. And in the 60s, designed the logo for Flora the Red Menace. Actually, he was a cartoonist on the side. Maybe he was even predominantly a cartoonist, but he used to do these characters called the Nebbishes, and that's one of the characters that you see in the Flora the Red Menace logo, that very frumpy looking person with the sign saying I am. That's written by that was drawn by Herb Gardner indeed, who would become a very successful playwright. He already had, in fact, by that point, because he'd already written the play A Thousand Clowns, which had done very well on Broadway and became a very acclaimed motion picture as well. So that's the answer to that question.
All right. What do we have for this week?
One of the rarest cast albums back in the 50s and 60s was Flahouli. It was a musical that was on Broadway only for 40 performances. It was Barbara Cook's debut in a musical. And a few years later, they did something that wasn't done often then, much more often now. They decided to try it again and maybe revise it and do some different things with it. I mean, in those days when a show closed, it was over. Nobody thought about it again. But these guys said, let's work on it. But they didn't want to call it Flahouli anymore. So what was the name they gave the show that was once called Flahouli at the Broadhurst Theater?
All right. So if you know that stuff, get over to BroadwayRadio.com. And there's contact information for Peter, Michael, and me, and let us know what you think. So on behalf of Michael Portantiere and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What are you doing? I said, come here. You need to do what I tell you to do. Listen to me. Daddy, come here. Hey, right here, right now, you're making me mad. Listen to me. Listen to me. Listen to me. I wanna play airplane. I wanna play airplane. I wanna play airplane. I wanna put my arms out and fly like the Red Baron in the Stop with Camel. No, wait. Like Superman up in the sky till I can see all of Pennsylvania.
Hey, give me a hand.
What'd you get, Daddy?
Right.
It's from Clyde Gibbons' barn. What a haul. He said, take what you want. I said, Clyde, are you sure? He said, it's all junk to me. I said, okay, Clyde, okay.